We'll go ahead and begin. A few more people are coming in here, I think, but and our clock is slow, so I'll have to find another way of tracking here. But welcome to everybody, and we're going to study what's been being called Portraits of the Disciples. In a minute, we'll talk a little bit about what we're going to cover in this quarter, but I've really enjoyed preparing for this. I've not taught this class before, nor really studied it that well. And so it's been really good to prepare for this, and I think you'll enjoy it. It's been really interesting to start to delve in a little bit into the lives of some of the followers of Christ in the first century, and I think we'll learn a lot from it. I certainly have so far, so I hope you'll take part. When I teach in the auditorium, I always make fun of the fact that we try to spread it out as far as we can. I think we end up in every section. And so please wave me down if you have some input to this, because we're going to talk about, you know, we're not going to have a ton of textual insight in some of these cases. And so we're going to have to look at what we've got and talk about it and try to understand what we learn from the disciples. And so in a minute, we'll talk about how we're going to go about this study. Let's bow and pray, and then we'll begin. Our Father in heaven, we're thankful for this time we have to be together and to study your word. We're thankful that you've preserved your word and given it to us so that we can honor you. We are thankful for your followers throughout time and for their hard work. And we ask that you would help us to continue that, and that you would help us to continue your work and help grow your kingdom. We're thankful to you more than anything for your son, Jesus Christ, and for his message. And it's through his name we pray, and amen. One of the first questions I got was, is this a class about the apostles or about others? And the answer is we're going to expand outside of just apostles. We are going to study certainly a number of the apostles. I'm not sure that I could fill a class up on Thaddeus. And so we might mention that, but there's not, you know, for some of the apostles, they're mentioned by name, and that's about all we have, or we know where they were. But so we are going to talk about the apostles for sure, but we're going to talk about many different disciples that we learn about in the New Testament. And so I'm kind of categorizing it as the followers of Christ. So I want to include John the Baptist and Mary and Martha and Mary Magdalene, Timothy and others that were down the line. There's people, really we're just going to look at profiles of people that we can learn from that were close to Jesus in the first century. Today, we're going to really talk more about context. And so we're going to start today, and I've done this before. If you've been in a class of mine before, you might have heard some of this. But I always like to look at, if we're going to talk about the people of the first century, certainly the ones at the turn of the millennium that were there close to Jesus, I want to look at the context of their society and their community, learn a little bit about just the general time period and what they were doing. So we're going to do that. But I want to talk first about the goals of what we're going to do in this class. And I hope that you'll expand on this a little bit in yourself. But I want to make sure you know what my goal is. First of all, I want to look at every single person that we study and try to understand more about the traits that Jesus valued. Interestingly enough, they are sometimes counterintuitive. And I think you'll find that there are ways that maybe if we were starting a ministry, we would have selected different people and done different things. But the first goal is to understand what traits Jesus valued. Secondly, we want to try to gain some empathy for the challenges of the disciples here right at the time of Jesus in beginning this ministry and what they had to deal with. We do also want to understand best how to leverage our own strengths and weaknesses. It's almost 50-50 with the disciples, the weaknesses and strengths that are documented. We don't have just a review of all the hero-like strengths of every single disciple. There are a lot of weaknesses demonstrated that we can learn from. And so we're going to look at both of those things, how to use that ourselves. We're also going to look at Jesus' ministry and find out how just regular people played a role in its growth. It was the most amazing movement ever started, and it has created amazing things. But we're going to try to understand how it is that Jesus used those people for the work of the kingdom and what we can do with that. And then the whole goal is for us to gain confidence so that we have purpose. We are a continuation of this kingdom and the growth of this kingdom. And so one of the goals we're going to have here is understand our purpose in this and how it relates. Obviously, there are differences, But we do what we want to try to understand the best we can what we can do in the kingdom and how we can be a proper disciple. So those are some of the things we're going to try to do here in this study. I guess one of the things I want to talk about first is the concept of a disciple. The word is used in a lot of different ways, but I'd like to talk about what does it mean to be a disciple. So I'll ask you that. When you define the word disciple, how do you define it? What is a disciple? A follower. That's one of the most important words when we talk about what a disciple is, a follower. Anything else you would mention? I would say student is another important one, because when you look at a disciple, it has a lot to do with being the student of another person. In fact, the term is used often in the dedicated students of a philosopher, even before the time of Jesus, disciples of a philosopher. And so in the case of being a disciple, it's important for us to recognize that it is a person who is dedicated to a teacher, is a follower, and the goal is for them to learn and model their lives, and even in many cases, to be part of a movement, to be part of a mission. Turn to John 8, if you don't mind. Let's look at John 8, because I think this is really one of the few cases in which some definition of what a disciple is given, particularly by Jesus. So I want to read a few verses in John 8, just to understand when we talk about a disciple, what we're talking about. Once again, we are going to talk about specifically the apostles, and some very special things related to the apostles of Jesus Christ, but also about the other disciples that followed him that were not necessarily imbued with power. And so in John 8, in verse 31, it says, "So Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed him, 'If you continue in my word, then you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free.' They answered him, We are Abraham's descendants and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free?' Jesus answered to them, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave of sin. Now the slave does not remain in the house forever. The son does remain forever. So if the son sets you free, you really will be free. I know that you are Abraham's descendants, yet you are seeking to kill me because my word has no place in you. I speak the things which I have seen with my father, therefore also do the things which you heard from your father." So this gives us a little bit of insight into the thinking of Jesus about what a disciple is. He starts off by speaking to the Jews that it says who had believed him. And he defines it as, if you continue in my word, then you are truly my disciples. What other word do you have besides continue? And it says, if you continue in my word, what other version is there of continue? Abide. Yeah, the idea of if you abide in my word or continue, the concept there is that, you know, and you know that before this in John 8, he is talking about, he's saying, me and the Father are one. He's talking about his relationship, his connection to the Father. And then here he says, if you continue in my word. This is a big deal for him to say to this group of people that the word is his word. But he says, if you abide in it, it has to do with this idea of dwelling. It has to do with a continuous process. It is not just hearing something and agreeing. It's not just feeling the same way. It is that something that changes you, becomes a part of you, and you are a part of. And so he says that if you are abide in my word or continue in my word, that's when you are truly my disciples. And then he follows up with one of the most famous statements in the New Testament. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. So it's interesting to me that when we ask the question here, of course we could have an entire quarter of classes about what is the truth, but when we learn a little bit about what he means when he says the truth is something that sets you free. And so he goes on here to describe a little more about what he means when he says this truth of Jesus Christ is something that frees us, that brings us freedom. Now, the response of those who are around him, it says, we are Abraham's descendants and have never been a slave to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free? Can anyone tell me why this was a preposterous statement? We are Abraham's descendants. We have never been enslaved to anyone. This is why I would have been a terrible Jesus, because my response would have been, what? What are you talking about? How about Egypt? How about how about Assyria and Persia? How about right now, Rome? The fact that they are so deluded that their response to him, their arrogant response to him would be, but we are the sons of Abraham. No one has ever enslaved us. Jesus kind of just lets that go. And he comes back and says, you are slaves. And your slaves, what he says here is the slave, he says, truly I say to you, everyone who commits a sin is a slave of sin. And his point is, you are a slave to yourself. And his comment here tells them, you're the worst kind of slave. You are a slave to yourself and you cannot be freed of your own volition. You are incapable of freeing yourself. You need the Son to free you. And so he goes on to say, you want to kill me now for what I'm saying because the word of God does not abide in you. It says, if you know the truth and you do the truth and you live by the word of my Father, you will have freedom, and that sin no longer is going to destroy you eternally. You now have an escape. And so I wanted to bring this up because when he says, you continuing my word makes you a disciple, I feel like that's as good a definition as we're going to get from the Bible about that. It is, we know the truth of Jesus Christ, we are followers of his, and his word lives in us, and we live in his word. It defines us. So we'll talk more about that as we go along, but I wanted to just talk a little bit there about the concept of a disciple. Now, I want to take a tangent here, and I want to take some time to talk about the time period in which these disciples lived, where they lived, and the situation they were in, because I think it will really help us, because I really want us to have a mental picture the best we can of who we are talking about. Now, I want to start with maybe a slightly inappropriate approach to this, but I'd like to ask you, stereotypically, if you talk about 2021 conservative church, the Church of Christ, is there a stereotypical picture of a disciple of Christ? I won't make you say it, but I think many of us would admit that there are some stereotypes about what conservative Christians are. If you walk into a Church of Christ in most any area in the country, it looks similar. It is middle-class people for the most part. It's people that aren't that rough looking. It is people that are white and black and Hispanic for the most part. There is a picture that we have in our head of this type of person. And often what happens is, if you look at movies, when you look at the way they depict Christians at the time of Christ, it's always very similar. It is usually a white guy with a long hair that's really good hair, usually, a well-kempt beard, and in some cases, just drop-dead gorgeous. And I bring this up not to be funny, but because I want us to have some perspective about the types of people we're talking about when we talk about the disciples of Jesus. They didn't likely look like that. Where were they from? Where were most of them from? They were from Palestine. They were from the Middle East. What was their descent? What was their nationality? This is the easiest question of the night. They were Jewish, and they were from the Middle East. That when we think about those people, we think about people that are from the Middle East, and that. So I'm not saying that we should necessarily that's really important to this, but it's going to become more important when we look at the lifestyle that they lived. But we certainly shouldn't think about it in just American terms, in the American church terms, and the middle class kind of clean type of conservative Christianity we have now. This was not squeaky clean. There was some scientists who made an effort to try to show, y'all might have seen this on the internet, to try to show what they think Jesus might have looked like, and we certainly have no idea. But it is interesting for us to see a picture of what scientists think that a person from the Palestine area, maybe from the area of Nazareth, looked like at the time of Jesus. And this was the picture that they put together. This is the kind of way they would cut their hair. This is the kind of way their beard would look, their complexion, and those types of things. I'd show you this not to say that we have any idea what any of these people looked like, but it is different. I want you to kind of clear your thinking out about what they looked like. Now, I will say this. I was complaining to somebody the other day. All of the writing and all of the things that at the time of Jesus, people did sculptures. People did art. People wrote. Yet we do not have a single description of what any of the people looked like at the time. Of course, they were not important enough to have a sculpture done. But man, I just wish, don't you wish somebody had said, and Jesus came in and his hair looked like this. And he kind of, but clearly it was not important. I was talking to, every time I have a question about history, I pick Wes Mallory's brain. And he made the point, those things are not important to them. They didn't have the thought, certainly thousands of years from now, people will want to know what this guy looked like. But now we think, since we have a picture of every human on earth, we really want that. But I would like to try to maybe talk about a profile a little bit of the first disciples and kind of what they were like. First of all, one of the things I think we always jump to is that the apostles and the first disciples were middle-aged guys. They very likely were not. Historically, it's most likely that they were between 18 and 25 years old. Therefore, there are a few reasons for that, that is what is supposed. One is that they had a rabbi who was, their rabbi was Jesus, and how old was he? He was 30. And so the fact that, you know, that they would not likely have a rabbi that was younger than them. We also know that they, two of them were the sons of Zebedee that were fishermen. They worked with their father, so it was likely that they were younger, might have even been teenagers. And I know this doesn't say a lot, but when I studied some of these things, they also sometimes were precocious. It's interesting, you know, you have the conversations where that when Jesus was away, what would they argue about? Yeah, who's the greatest in the kingdom, and who's going to be, and their mom is, hey, can mine sit on the right and the left? And there are some characteristics we see that seem precocious and seem young. Their humility, their willingness, the fact that they didn't have things tying them down, and when Jesus came and said, "Follow me," they said, "Okay, I'll go." So it's not likely that when you think about them as younger people. You know, like for example, you know, who in here is, Drew, how old are you? 22. I think that's probably in the sweet spot of about the age. And you might think, Drew, man, he has no right being an apostle. He's not good at anything. But they were. So, Clay, how old are you? Oh, there's another Clay. You're 33. How about this one? 30. Too old. Aged out. Brian, how old are you? 21. Yeah, see, I think you're starting to get a picture here of when the clays are aged out. They didn't seem to appreciate me saying that. But you start to think about, you know, it's Taylor Leggett who's standing out there, and Brian and Drew. These are the age group and probably the personality type of people who were, well, let me ask you that question. We'll move on here in a second. Most of them were fishermen that we know of. We only really know a little bit about the apostles, and we know that a number of them were fishermen. We know one was a tax collector. One was a zealot, but that's not really a profession. That's more of just a kind of a revolutionary. But the most of that we know about were fishermen. Why is it that Jesus would select people in that age range and with that type of a profession? Do you have thoughts about that? First of all, I think that's probably one of the most important things. These are people who had demonstrated a work ethic. They were hard workers and they were dedicated. Any other thing you can think about that might be why he would choose them? Yeah, I mean, I think that the idea of them being young. And not just the practicality of they have the ability to dedicate themselves to a mission, but that they might be more open-minded, might be more willing. Now, I will say that historically, the most likely, these were not uneducated people. These are not people who were just, you know, when we think about fishermen, you know, we might think that they were uneducated, but these were likely people who finished synagogue school, who had some knowledge of the law. But they might have been open-minded and been willing to dedicate themselves to a movement. Any other things you can think of? I think another is the development of loyalty. I think that the younger people, they might have found people that were young, that they had a profession that demonstrated that they were hard workers and that they were loyal. And Jesus sought them out and said, these are the right people to start the biggest movement in the world. I mentioned here also that they lived in a Hellenistic culture. And I wanted to mention this because I wanted to talk a little bit about the culture that they lived in. They, when we talk about Hellenistic culture, this really has to do with cultures that are adopting a Greek lifestyle. Alexander the Great in the 4th century, a Greek king in Macedonia, pretty much just started conquering everything through Europe and the Middle East and in Asia. And what kept happening was, as that flowed through, Greek culture started being injected into everything. And so here in Palestine, in the year 30, they were living in a society where they were Jewish. They were living a Jewish lifestyle that was mixed up with the Roman oversight and with Greek culture. And so that's what we mean when we talk about they were living in a Hellenistic society that was a mixture of those things. And it's very likely that they were simple people. We know that their profession was, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second, their profession was a hard one. It was a hard-working, honest profession. But they did not live with luxuries. They did not live in fancy places. These were not rich people. These were people that were working hard every day to make a living. So that's the type of people that were the first disciples. And we'll see as we learn about other disciples, they follow that pattern. I guess I'll ask this question. Who did Jesus not select? He showed up at 30 ready to start his mission, and there was a society there already with a strong religious infrastructure. Who did he not select to begin his movement? What's that? Yeah, he did not select him. He paved the way, but that wasn't a person that was selected as an apostle. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, not the Sanhedrin. Wouldn't that be the most obvious? That, you know, the experts in the law, the people with some leadership. Maybe select some of them. What did you say? Yeah, the old dudes. Of course, I made fun of the 30-year-olds. And the 50-year-old guys that were on the Sanhedrin, they weren't even, not even considered. They were practically dead. And so the idea here of selecting these regular people, young men, was important to the success of the movement. He did not select the Pharisees or the scribes or the Sanhedrin or the others that had already established some type of a mission. It was really important to him to pick the right kind of person. Now he picked, from what we know, for the most part, we think that at least the ones that were named and maybe others were fishermen. And I wanted to talk just a little bit about fishing in Galilee. You know, this was the land, and I'll talk probably a lot about the area in different ways. You know, this was, when we talk about Israelites, now Israel at this time wasn't a place. Israel was a nation of people. And I guess until 1948, it was not a place. The area we call Palestine, it's now also still called that, the Palestine area. Palestine actually means land of the Philistines. That's what you might have even heard it called Philistia. What was it called before it was called Palestine? Do you know what it was before? What was it in the Old Testament? It was Canaan. I mean, this is the Promised Land, and so this is now, and what we call now the Middle East. It was probably called at that time Galilee or Judea by the Romans in particular, because it was right here at the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee, how many of y'all have visited, have been to the Sea of Galilee? Anybody here? I have not, so you have. It's bigger than I imagined in my head, but yeah, it is 23 miles by 7 miles. It is a big sea that is very appropriate for fishing. And it was a core industry in the area. Fishing was basically, you know, go out, catch fish. Of course, there was people like Matthew sitting there to do what when you came in with your catch? You tax it. And then once you paid your people, then you would sell it, and that's how you made a living. I studied a little bit about the fishing where they would sell the fish that were of size. The smaller ones and all the guts would all kind of be put into a container and fermented. And that's where if you eat Asian food, it is fish sauce, which is really good, by the way. It was made by the fermenting and of all of these fish parts. And still in Jewish culture, there is a thing that kind of is in the tradition of that, which is kind of the fermented fish. Do you know what that is? You ever heard of the fermented fish in Jewish culture? It's called gefilte fish. And it is a nasty gelatin mess full of fish parts that is very important in Jewish culture. But that's kind of what they would do. They would catch fish. They'd sell them. All the extra they would use in things that were for flavoring or for things like that. The fish they were catching was, they call it now St. Peter's fish, but at the time it was tilapia, carp, and catfish. Do you know why it would be interesting for a Jewish person to buy or to catch catfish? You know, that is that's not a clean fish. You know, if you've caught a catfish, you know, it is a disgusting fish, but it tastes really good. But they would not eat catfish, but they would catch it and they would sell it. And so those were the main fish they were catching there, tilapia, carp, and catfish. Now, I watch a TV show that has really helped me understand how important fishing industry is and how important catching fish is, particularly at this time period and to this economy. If you ever want to come to an understanding of how important fish is, watch the TV show Alone on the History Channel. Anybody watch Alone? Just a couple people. It is a show that basically has people that get dropped off in a desolate area, and they have to see who can stay there the longest. And whoever stays there the longest with no, they have nothing. They have a backpack with basically a knife and a tarp. And whoever can stay there the longest wins $500,000. How important is fish to people on Alone? It is, if they get them, if they catch them, they win. If they don't, they practically die. And it's interesting that when you see here that if they go out there and they successfully catch fish, it's a good business and it keeps this society running. And there are obviously other ways to make money here and to have food, but fishing was core to that. So I just wanted to mention that we know that fishing in Galilee, so we think about the fishermen at this time. I put some pictures on there that are pretty good examples of the types of boat they would be using. They would go out in a pretty small boat. It was probably just 20 feet by 7 feet, and bring nets, and they would go out a ways and bring in catches of fish. And you can imagine that little boat there. When you think about Jesus sending them out, and it said it filled up their boat and they were about to sink, you can kind of get an idea of how many fish were there in that boat. So I just wanted to mention that because I feel like it's important for us to understand what the trade that they were in and the time period. I do want to talk also just a minute about the state of the world at this time. I think it's always interesting to understand that we're talking about Judea and about people in Judea, but here's what else was going on in the world at that time. Most of the world population at this time was in China and in India and Europe. Europe including the Middle East. China was by far the largest. The entire world population at the time was about 200 million. So smaller than the population of the United States was the world population. China was the largest. About 22% of the population was in China, and the Han Dynasty was going on then. Europe and the Middle East, this was the Roman Empire there, and about 45 million people. In Judea, in the Palestine area, there were about 600,000 people. Think about the population of Tampa, not including St. Petersburg and Clearwater. The Tampa area on this side of the bridge is about 600,000 people. That was the number of people we're talking about. And then India still had a large population of about 10 million people. I did a diagram to show you. This is a heat map of the first century world. So this is in the year one. This is what, if you look at, see the yellow dot? That's a million people. And so you can see here that we've got Asia and India, a little bit in Europe and Africa, but, you know, North America, South America, very little going on there. To compare, this is now. So this is about 200 million people or so. This is 7 billion and how they're spread out. You see, it's still weighted in a similar way when we talk about the world population. So I just wanted to point out that there were a lot of people in the world going on, and when we talk about a few hundred thousand people in this area where this movement started that changed the world. A few other things just to mention about the state of the world at the time. Buddhism had been for 500 years the most popular religion in Europe, and was spreading from India, where it had really begun and grown, and it was now spreading into China. Confucius, if we talk about disciples of philosophers, some of the most famous, Confucius and Aristotle and Plato, they had lived and died 300 to 500 years before this. So when you think about your time period of Greek philosophers and of Chinese philosophers, they had lived hundreds of years before this. And Judea, as we know, had become a Roman province. This Middle Eastern area in Judea had, under the Emperor Tiberius Caesar Augustus, had become a Roman province. And so this is kind of the world that they lived in. And it is, I tell you this just to understand the context of where we are and what's going on. There's a lot going on in the world. And by the way, there was a world to spread this mission to. This movement had a lot of places to go, and it started conceivably with 13 people. And when he says, go into the world and teach, this has a lot to do with that. This has a lot to do with how big a job there is to spread this. So I'll ask you a question a little bit. You know, we talk a little bit about the profile of the 21st century Christians and who we are and what we're like. And we see a little bit of a profile, a little bit of a picture into the year 30 disciples. Are we anything like them? Is there any comparison that we're going to be able to make to say, we have something to learn from these people? Are there ways that you would compare our situation? Or is it just really hard to make a connection between being a Christian in 2021 versus 30? Yes. What do you think that Peter and Andrew and James and John thought they were going to be doing before Jesus came along? Do you think that they had any idea that they were about to join a rebel movement where Christianity would be? They thought, I'm a Jewish young person. I have learned Jewish law. My parents are Jewish. Their mindset was, I'm going to be going down this path right here and just keep doing this. It makes me think about what we call the rich young ruler. when he asked, you know, what do I have to inherit eternal life? His mindset was, I've been doing all the stuff and I'm going to continue doing that stuff. That I think your point you make about a random thing happened to a regular person, no offense, and that it changed the trajectory of their life and changed the trajectory of other people's lives. I'm a second generation Christian. My parents were the first Christians in their families, and they actually ended up converting both of their parents, but they were the first Christians, so I consider myself a second generation Christian. How many people in here are a third or higher generation Christian? A few. How many are five or more? Anybody a fifth? Yeah, there are a number here of fifth generation Christians. It is very different than a first generation Christian or a second. Although, as a second generation, all I've ever known is sitting in a pew like this. Ours, the back was not padded, but the bottom was padded, so it was roughing it. And it was, I sat in a room like this, sang out of Songs of the Church, John Kilgore preached, and that's what I knew from when I was little. How many in this room are first generation Christians? A few. There is something different about that. You have a perspective that is important. It is so important, by the way, that there are first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. How many is it, Drew? Are you sixth or you don't even know? Yeah. It goes back to Adam. Is that okay? Yeah. He's 150th generation Christian. But it is so important, that perspective. I tell the story. I've told it in my hospitality class one time, and Brian is getting sick of me saying it, but I loved seeing Brian and Chris Bell. He was a first-generation Christian. His wife also, Jean, is a first-generation Christian. The White family, Missy's family, converted her, who converted him, and now an elder of this church. That perspective is so important. I think I would feel nervous if there was an eldership in a church that had only sixth-generation Christians in it. And so I bring that up to say that there are people in this room who remember the gospel being introduced to them as an adult. They remember having a trajectory of their life that was changed. And now, I remember when I was converted and baptized, but I remember the conservative church for my entire life. And I love learning from people who it was introduced to them and they had to change. I remember sitting at around a table with Alex Chong years and years ago. And I'm not telling you this because I had any role in his conversion, but I remember talking to him and with Ho-Jung about Alex considering becoming a Christian. He comes from a denominational background, and not just from denominational, from people who were leaders in denominational churches. Now, and I told you before, you know, we talk about the profile of our church, and just, you know, if we're being very honest, Asian people in the Church of Christ is not highly common. I have learned a lot about Korean culture from Ho-Jung and Alex, and Chinese culture from Ming-Wei and Zhen, and about Indian culture from Christopher and Rena. But the fact that we were talking to Alex, and the fact that he had to think about a big change, a walking away. I almost compare it to fishing and saying, follow me, and having to make that decision to walk into a very difficult change. I feel like that we need to be very, very respectful of the fact that sometimes our perspective needs to be shared. And that is the purpose of the church. The very purpose of the church is the diversity of people that come together. They share their experiences. They share their strengths and their weaknesses. A bond is created and burdens are shared. And the kingdom grows because of that. It tells me that we improve the quality and power of our local church by increasing its diversity. And I don't just mean ethnic diversity, though I do. I mean socioeconomic, I mean background, I mean occupational. Every way that we can grow the kingdom in this local church in diversity helps us accomplish Jesus' purpose. And so when I think about, is there anything to learn from this? I think that we will learn from each other by getting to know each other and our backgrounds. The fact is, there were people who just raised their hands. I had no idea what generation you were or that you were a first generation. That's right there is interesting. But I would like to say that the goal of what we're trying to do here is to look at some people who were Jewish young people who had something introduced to them, and they heard it, and they believed it, and they followed it, and they made a huge difference in the world. That is our responsibility right now. The fact that we have the opportunity to take that gospel and bring it to people who need it, and it will change their lives, is our same purpose. That is the way that in which we are a disciple. And so next time we're going to start looking at some people, and I want to start with one of my favorites, but one that I consider to be the first disciple. And we're going to look at the story of Andrew, not just because I love the name. If you don't know, my son is named that, but I want to study Andrew, and I think if you know him, you know why I call him the first disciple. There are a couple times in Andrew's life where he did something that was really important to the kingdom, and we want to learn from that. And so we're going to study Andrew next time, and if you can look and study about him a little bit, I would appreciate that. We're also going to continue to look at the general mindset of the disciples at this time. I hope that what I did today helps you, gives you a little bit of an understanding of a few things. One is the types of people they were, the challenges. Does anybody else see the fly that's flying in my face? Am I the first to see it? Okay. I might be losing my mind also. But I want us to understand not only the types of people they were, the qualities that Jesus saw in them, why they were so powerful and helpful to that, and the fact that it was really hard. What they did was extremely difficult, and in many cases, it led to their death. But I'd like us to think about that when we look at starting with Andrew, and we'll look at some of the other apostles, what it is they had to do to commit themselves to this purpose. And maybe most importantly, understand that they were simple, regular people that accomplished great things. And the reason I want to make sure we think about that when we look at these people is I think sometimes we make the mistake of believing that in order to be truly useful in the kingdom, we have to be an intellectual giant, or we have to have a great enlightenment about the philosophy of Scripture, or we have to have great leadership skills, or we have to have great resources. Almost every single person we're going to study in this class was simple and poor and had a lifestyle that was not necessarily desirable and did not necessarily have any gifts that would have made them particularly good at this. What they had was willingness and loyalty and grit and a work ethic and an honest willingness to hear something and when they believe it, act on it. So I'd like us to think about that and think about our purpose and what we can do. And next time we'll start in studying Andrew and see what we can learn from him. Thank you very much for your input tonight. Look forward to studying with you Wednesday.